I'm John Kroll. Teacher strikes and other signs of dissatisfaction have popped up across America. Today on No Limits, we'll explore the state of education and the morale of educators here in Indiana. My guests are teachers Ronnie Moore and Nick Brewer, and Indiana State Teachers Association President Teresa Meredith. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. It's not a secret. Teacher strikes and other signs of dissatisfaction in the classroom and in schools have popped up across America in places as far-flung as West Virginia, Arizona, Oklahoma, nearby in Kentucky. So today on No Limits, we're going to explore the state of education and the morale of educators here in Indiana, maybe see if there are some connections. If you want to join this important conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are two teachers. Well, actually, I guess technically it's three teachers, but one of them is in another capacity. Teachers Ronnie Moore and Nick Brewer, and Indiana State Teachers Association President Teresa Meredith. Welcome, all of you, to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
So we probably ought to start. Let's put this in some sort of context, because I think part of what goes on is people look at even here, where we have been through the education wars for well more than a decade now, there's been a lot of back and forth, but we think that it is specific to our place, that we're alone and that everybody else is doing it right. It turns out that's not the case. That's, I think, been one of the eye-openers for a lot of Americans right now, is that there is unrest and frustration all across the country with this. Let's talk a bit about the causes of that. I'm going to start with Ronnie on that.
Yeah, so some of the causes of the unrest has been the frustration in some places with lack of proper facilities and resources for students. In addition to teacher pay and benefits, the fact that education funding in some places has been cut upwards of 30%, and raises continue to stay, the actual salaries may be stagnant in certain places. So that's definitely a huge reason why this is happening now.
Nick, your take.
I think especially across states, one of the reasons you're seeing it happening is because it's starting to work, that a lot of these legislatures are starting to respond to teachers and to give raises and increased funds. I think it was Arizona promised 20% raise over 2 years. So once you see it work once, I think that kind of inspires you to keep it going. So I think we're in kind of a new phase of activism for a teacher's perspective.
Is this Teresa, I'm going to reframe the question slightly for you, because
sure,
you're representing the state's largest teacher union here, teachers union. There was a time, for those of us who have some memory of Indiana politics, when the Indiana State Teachers Association and the State Chamber of Commerce were by far the two most powerful, most effective lobbying organizations. Often they fought over issues in the legislature. Most recently, with a lot of this stuff, perception has been that ISTA has lost ground, has not had the kind of clout that it did at one point. You know, lost a series of political battles. Is this a sign, perhaps, that the tide is turning once again?
We've been seeing for several years now that the tide was beginning to turn. We weren't sure exactly what the catalyst was or the exact point in time that it began, but we are definitely seeing a turn. And when you look across the country at all of the issues, there seems to be a common thread, the thread of the lack of respect for the profession and the lack of focus on what students need to be successful in our public schools. You know, public schools are the backbone of our democracy, and we have in some ways turned our backs on that as taxpayers by not holding our legislators accountable to support that mechanism for providing a stable democracy.
What accounts for the fact that I'm going to pick up on Nick's point and Ronnie's as well, that that people stopped listening to teachers? I mean, how did that happen?
I think the community still, by and large, and has consistently for some time, still continued to listen to teachers to a point. The political piece, I think so many people didn't want to believe that education, particularly public education, was a political piece that needed to be discussed with legislators. And I think they're finally waking up to that and seeing that, wait a minute, the people that we've elected aren't necessarily listening to what we want for our community public schools. And so we have yet to see folks begin to connect the dots between what's happening in our public schools and who they just put into office.
Okay, so I'm going to ask this of Nick and then Ronnie, because one of the perceptions, one of the criticisms we hear of these strikes is that teachers are just after more money that they want, which, and I'll frame it, I can't think of a person who goes into work at any day and doesn't expect to be paid for that work. But I'll just ask, what were the reasons that you went into education? What were the things that motivated you? Was one of them the hope that you would get rich doing this? Or I know you're laughing, but I'm going to ask the question. I'll start with Nick.
I certainly didn't get into it to get rich, but I thought I would be able to provide for a family. I really try not to focus too much about my personal pay, because I did know what I was getting into when I got into being a teacher. I knew I wasn't going to strike it rich. I think one of my greatest dissatisfactions is the lack of funding for students and student programs, student facilities. We hear a lot of we need to prepare students for the 21st century jobs, but I'm lucky that I actually work in a district that's very supportive.
Which district?
Washington Township. And the staff, the administration, and the public around there passed a referendum about 2 years ago to help fund public education. But it's a little astounding to me that they had to. And you say about a decade ago, and that's when a lot of that stuff started coming down, where they changed the financing laws. You couldn't do school construction and all this different stuff. So we have very well-maintained buildings, but we have buildings that are 60 years old. And so we're supposed to be preparing people for the next generation of jobs when we don't necessarily have the funding to do that. And that's a big frustration.
Ronnie, how about you? Tell us a little bit about your story.
Yeah, so I got into education because I was a former special education student in kindergarten. I was placed into special education, and 2 years later, I was placed in gifted and talented. And so that first interested me in education in terms of figuring out how to help students who are on both sides of the aisle, having been one of those students that that had that experience. So it honestly, this whole strike is not not entirely about money in terms of for teachers. Honestly, at the heart of this is teachers trying to focus on being good stewards of the money that is provided for schools. And so we want to make sure that the teachers, the boots on the ground, are having a voice at the table in terms of saying, you know, hey, we may need more resources for students in this way or that way, and that should be understood. So, yeah, that's my story.
Okay. We are talking about the state of education and the morale of educators here in Indiana on No Limits today. Obviously, there are teacher strikes going on across the country and other walkouts of the classroom. In that environment, we want to discuss what is happening in our classrooms and our schools. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. So, Teresa, and I want to hear everyone's thoughts on this. If this is not, the frustration is not about money. I mean, I do hear that people want to be paid a decent wage for doing their work. Then what are the sources of frustration? What are the friction points that are producing this now? So and I want to hear everyone's thoughts, but I'm starting with Teresa.
I think it is about money in terms of compensation, yes. School resources, yes. Those things don't just fall from the sky. And, you know, I'm looking here in the studio and I'm seeing technology and microphones and headphones, and I bet you didn't bring those with you today. I bet they were here and they were provided.
Oh, no, these are my toys.
Did
yes.
you pull these out of your back pocket?
No.
But if I were, you know, I remember a time in a classroom when I was providing the headphones and I was providing some of the extra equipment that I felt my students needed to be up with current technology and current learning practices. So that's a frustrating point. In terms of salary, when you go outside of suburban Indiana and you look at the rural schools or some of our urban communities, those teachers have been flatlined for a very long time. And I want to pick on the rurals just for a little bit. Pick on's not the right word. I guess highlight. Particularly in rural areas in Indiana, their salaries have remained pretty much the same and have grown little to none, with the exception of periodically maybe a little stipend being thrown their way. If their school got a little extra money and they were a highly effective teacher, they might have gotten a couple of $100 as a stipend, but that didn't change their personal income. And so everything else in their life went up in cost, but their income didn't. And they're still providing so many things for their classrooms on that same limited income. And so, yeah, it's not necessarily just about teacher pay, but it is about school funding and how we support our public schools. I think there's the teacher evaluation piece. There's the test score piece. It's just little by little, it's been building up over the years. And teachers have across the country, not just teachers, but even education support professionals as well, who've seen a lot of privatization happen of the work that they do, like driving buses and cleaning our schools and supporting our students. Everyone's frustrated.
Ronnie, when you talk about the lack of school resources, what sorts of things are you talking about specifically?
So what I know from what the teachers are asking for in other states, there are teachers who have books that are falling apart, buildings that are not modernized at all. And I know that there are some schools that don't have adequate access to even an internet connection. So these are the sorts of things that we need to be able to do our jobs effectively.
Nick,
mm-hmm.
what are the resources that you find are lacking? And what should we be talking about?
Sure. Well, I think the more teachers you have in any given situation to help reduce class sizes, also to get some specialty content like a computer coding teacher or something like that would go a long way to preparing students for the next generation of jobs. But also, for example, you said headphones. I had to go through a funding donorschoose.org to get headphones for my class because all told, if you wanted headphones that weren't destroyed in about 2 weeks, they cost about $400. And I just didn't have $400 on me that I could go buy those. So I had to go get a grant, and I was lucky enough to do that. But that's the kind of thing where sometimes we, to maximize the resources that we do have, we just need the little bit extra so I can have headphones and have kids watch videos that are tailored to their learning, or I can read a test and have them listen to that at the same time. So just those little things to help the entire education process make things just go so much smoother.
Are there, and I'll ask Ronnie and Nick each this, the example Ronnie mentioned, and we have seen these stories in other states where literally they've got textbooks that are falling apart and all of that. Do we see that here in Indiana? And I guess, Teresa, since actually I probably ought to direct that since you've got the statewide view. Do we have instances of that here in Indiana?
We do, because school corporations are having to choose now whether they have they don't have enough funding for everyone to receive textbooks, but they're having to make the choice between technology or hard book. And if they're going to do one, can they find a way to support the other? And many times they can't.
We are talking about the state of education here in Indiana and the morale of Hoosier educators. You're probably aware there have been school walkouts and teacher strikes in many places in this country, which made it clear that this is a cause of national concern. We're going to talk more about the situation here in Indiana with my guests, teachers Ronnie Moore and Nick Brewer, and Indiana State Teachers Association President Teresa Meredith. If you want to join the conversation, please call us at 866-476-3881. You can email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about the state of education and the morale of educators here in the wake of school walkouts and teacher strikes that have happened across America. My guests are teachers Ronnie Moore and Nick Brewer and Indiana State Teachers Association President Teresa Meredith. If you want to join the conversation, please send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Or you can do what a listener named Elaine has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Elaine, you're on the air.
Hi. I am a teacher in Indianapolis, and I was just calling because I feel like a large part of the frustration and the issues that go along with being a special education teacher right now is that our mandates and our expectations come down from the national and state level from people who aren't actually educators.
Thanks very much for the call and the comment. Yeah, this doesn't work well in a non-visual medium, but I'm seeing heads nod up and down here in agreement with you, Elaine. Thanks very much for the call. So who wants to weigh in first on that one?
I can talk briefly about that. It's one of those things where everybody went to school, so they think they know how to run a school. Mm-hmm. It's important to remember that when people get into these positions, they're really doing it in earnest and trying to help the school. No one gets into politics or education to hurt people, I feel like, and they might have different methods of getting around to creating something, but it's so important to listen to the educators when you are making those kind of decisions. If I was having a house built, I would listen to the people building the house as to whether or not something needed to be changed or something needed to be whatever. And I think when we talk about these policy discussions, it's important, like the caller was saying, that we listen to teachers and we don't just throw mandates down without necessarily understanding the feasibility of that.
Where does that, Teresa, because this is a product of those political wars. At one of the things as an observer that has astounded, and I've been a journalist for more years than I'm supposed to talk about over the radio. But one of the things as this battle, which really started, back in the early 80s with A Nation at Risk and all of that, the real politicization of education, at some point, the folks who proclaimed themselves to be in favor of education reform decided that the teachers were obstacles rather than vehicles for those reforms. When and why did that occur, Teresa? I mean, from your perspective, admittedly, you're coming at it from a very clear point of view, but that.
Sure. Well, I was in college. This dates me a bit during the A Nation at Risk. And as I started my teaching career, that's
just
what everyone was talking about.
Yeah.
So I think Well, I think that that report caused other people to start talking about education that hadn't been part of the conversation before, and it created a perception that there were some real problems. And I'm not sure that perception was true. I don't believe some of what was in that report was valid. And so I think politicians began stepping up and talking more, and they didn't want to talk with the real educators to talk about what the issue was and how best to solve it, because it took time to do that. And they might actually have to yield to someone who actually knows what they're talking about. It was a lot easier to just legislate and keep moving on. And that seems to be, as an educator, how it has happened for years.
And I guess I want to pick up on the dynamic, and I'm aware in my profession, it is everybody's read a newspaper, so they all know how to be journalists, and which, you know, I always respond by saying, well, I have a checking account. That must make me qualified to be president of a bank. But, you know, at what point did we stop seeing teaching as something that requires a special set of skills? Because a lot of the reforms we've talked about now are about, you know, having teachers who aren't trained or even, you know, finding ways around preparing teachers for the classroom.
It really began, I think, under Governor Daniels' leadership in our state. There was a major funding cut from public education that helped begin the surplus that we have in Indiana. And that $300 million that was cut was never restored. And so then when you look at the accumulating $300 million per year over time, it's no wonder that our rural schools are being bled to death and having to figure out how they're going to survive for a few more months or maybe for another year and then regroup. So that, for my personal teaching career, seemed to be the time period when that really became true here in Indiana. You saw a real rise in reforms that were not necessarily vetted or discussed well with the educators here in this community.
We are talking about the state of education and the morale of educators here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, please send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on social media or do what Joseph has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Joseph, you're on the air.
Hi. I have kind of a question and a comment. So my brother-in-law is a teacher. My sister was a teacher. And I've seen kind of the struggles they went through. One of them taught in a parochial school, one in a public school. And he teaches at Center Grove. And, for example, I know, you know, funds are tight all over, but they put lights on their middle school football field, and they don't play at night. And I asked him about it, and he commented that, well, you know, if we didn't spend that money, we would have lost it. And I was like, why didn't you buy more computers? And he said, well, that's not how it works. You can't commingle those funds. It's different buckets. Like, if times are so tough, why are we doing things like putting lights on a middle school football field when they don't play at night?
Joseph, we'll see if we get an answer for you. Thanks very much for the call and the question. Thanks. So, Ronnie, I mean, do you see instances of that around you where, you know, funds that could be used in desperately needed areas instead are redirected or restricted from actually being applied? Redirected is probably not the right verb there. Restricted from being used where they're needed because they have been designated for areas where there isn't a great need.
Sure. So from my position as a teacher, I don't deal as much with the budget, of course, but what I can see is in many school districts, funds being allocated for example, technology, getting everyone iPads, which is it's arguable that, you know, being a one-to-one school could be helpful, but In certain situations where students don't have access to certain other things, it's not maybe the best decision that could be made with the money that is being allocated. So I've definitely seen instances of that happening, and it can be very frustrating, especially for a teacher who might be better positioned to inform the people who are making the decisions as to what the money should actually be spent on.
Nick, you look like you want to say something.
Well, as a football coach and track coach, sometimes those lights are needed. But the caller's father-in-law is absolutely right that sometimes the way the funds get allocated is a little Byzantine. Mm-hmm. And it's you can't just take money from one bucket to the other. You can have a referendum, which in my district we had to do. It was completely tax neutral. But when you start putting ballot measures like that on the docket, it gets people scared that you're about to raise their taxes.
Yeah.
And then when you start talking about ballot measures, after school referenda began to be passed, and then after Superintendent Ritz was elected, the legislature decided to pass a law to make it not appropriate. It's actually a crime for you to discuss during school time a school referendum or prepare documents, send home with parents on school time. You can't do any publication or publicity for that school referendum on school time in your role as a teacher to the parent. So that creates a real challenge for a school system. When you need a referendum passed and you need to be able to communicate with those parents and you have a captive audience, why can't you do that? And so it's been a very difficult circumstance for some of our schools fighting for these school referenda.
I suspect the answer to your question, and I'm playing devil's advocate here because I see, and this is probably one of those times when I have to do my standard disclosure for the audience, that in an earlier part of my life, I was the executive director of what is now the ACLU of Indiana. So First Amendment issues are priority and something I have a lot of experience with. I suspect, though, that critics of your position would argue that the phrase is there in captive audience, that because the audience can't get up and walk out or cannot refuse to listen at that point, that is the reason that they don't want the discussion taking place. We are talking about education and the morale of educators here on No Limits today. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what Mike has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
One of my biggest concerns, at least in red states, about the public education landscape is sort of this injection of right-wing politics into this landscape. Especially science curricula, right, with maybe teaching alternative evolution or having tepid curricula surrounding climate change, these sorts of things. And I didn't know how that manifests itself in Indiana, if that's a real problem here, if science teachers feel like they have autonomy in this state, or do they feel, handcuffed or neutered by the legislature here and in that arena anyway.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Mike. Teresa.
Sure.
I think it depends on the community in which a school is in as to how much leeway that teacher might have, what kind of curriculum has been approved by that school board. In terms of the legislature, I would say it's more on the conservative side than it is being open, but there hasn't been a hot debate yet about the topics that he mentioned at the state level, but there have been in some of our local school systems.
Are there any schools in the state where creation science is taught? I've heard rumors of one in northeastern Indiana for years.
I'm sure there is. I'd have to go back and look, but I couldn't tell you right now for sure.
So in terms of is this one of the areas of frustration, too, in terms of the I don't even know how to describe it. I would say adversarial way even the curricula are fashioned here in Indiana, where that process, too, has become very much politicized. Teresa's leaning in, I want to hear everyone's thoughts.
Well, I just want to throw one thing out about that. Look at what happened at the state board meeting when we were first beginning to talk about graduation pathways, and the state superintendent of public instruction voted against. She spoke against. She wanted the state board to slow down and be a little bit more thoughtful and careful and clear in its planning. And they ignored that. You had teachers, superintendents, parents, massive numbers of people speak against. And the state board ignored that. And they proceeded down that path. So that's just an example of one issue where educators really are the experts. And that expertise was ignored. And so I would say it probably bleeds over into a curriculum as well when you're talking about specific school districts.
Yeah, I want to hear both of you, since you're boots on the ground here. Tell me what your experience has been. Nick's leaning in, but I want to hear Ronnie's thoughts, too.
In my experience, I've never been asked to censor my curriculum. Obviously, I have a set curriculum that I need to follow, and I think that's appropriate that we have that kind of outline for our teachers. But I've never been asked to censor what I can teach, and I've been given the freedom. But again, I'm a suburban school in Indianapolis, and that might not be true of all school districts in Indiana. In the science question, I know that a couple of my good friends who are science teachers have not been asked to censor their lessons either.
Mm-hmm. Ronnie.
I've had much the same experience. I'm very fortunate to work at a school district where we're involved in every step of the curriculum process. Our curriculum services director opens up the floor for all of our instructors to weigh in on which standards should be addressed and how students will be assessed.
What was the uproar? Because for most people who are not about even the question of Common Core, which was something that that seemed on both sides of the divide there, the cultural divide, to send people into states of upset that seemed disproportionate to the discussion involved. Nick, you're nodding your head.
I got into education right around when Common Core was coming around, and I never quite understood the level of vitriol for people opposing Common Core necessarily. The one thing I do know that people objected most strongly about Common Core is that it was a national mandated curriculum and that Indiana has specific needs and should be allowed to teach those. I'm not sure I ever fully bought into that particular line of thinking. And in my line of thinking, good teaching is good teaching. And so if the Common Core was good teaching, I was okay with it.
Was that, I mean, my understanding, though, is it really wasn't a curriculum. It was just this is a set of standards we're going to use so that we determine how everyone is measuring up and that, you know, the ruler everywhere is going to have 12 inches on it. It's not going to be 10 inches in some places, 14 inches in others. Teresa, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, that it was meant to be that standard or a bar for which to aim. And I think the fact that it had national in front of it as the National Common Core here in Indiana, people tend to cringe when they think anything's coming down from the federal level. That's and they felt it was a mandate. As a teacher, there were concerns within certain parts of the standards, but I knew that we could work through those concerns. For example, the order of certain skills that were taught in math. Mm-hmm. I knew we could work through that. But yeah, it was the idea that it was a national thing that was being pushed down.
I've gotten a Facebook comment from a listener named Len. And again, if you want to join the conversation via Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. Lynn writes, I believe the General Assembly has a law that capital funds and educational funds can't be commingled. As a former special education teacher for IPS, I believe this is a mistake that benefits the construction lobby and others and doesn't allow the local district to increase spending for the classroom. Teresa, your thoughts?
I'd have to go and check that fact. I think she is correct on that, though I know the funds, those two accounts cannot be commingled. And there may be some credibility to what she's saying with regard to the construction lobby. I don't know. But I know that schools cannot mix those funds, and it does create a challenge at the end of the day when they can't, when they're worried about how they're going to meet certain needs, and yet over here they've got this funding that they have to spend or they're going to lose it.
Where, Ronnie, where do you find in your school area the biggest gaps are where more money would make a difference?
Well, my school has done a really good job of just making sure that everyone has what they need. Just full disclosure, I work for the Excel Center, which is a part of the Goodwill Education Initiatives. So I haven't found that we have major gaps in where our funding needs to go. They've been very receptive to teacher voice in terms of allocating money where it needs to go, from my perspective.
We've gotten another Facebook message from a listener named Christina. Again, you can find us at No Limits WFYI on Facebook. It says, Christina writes, FYI, Brewer said the MSDWT referendum was tax neutral. That is very inaccurate. The tax impact was significant, but still passed by a huge margin, happily.
I should clarify that. We had a referendum before this previous referendum, and this previous referendum, she is correct, was not tax neutral. And we had a very supportive community that was willing to fill the gap between funding and what we needed. But the previous one was a referendum to commingle those buckets.
We are going to continue our conversation about the state of education and the morale of educators here in Indiana in the wake of teacher strikes and other signs of dissatisfaction across the country. My guests are teachers Ronnie Moore and Nick Brewer and Indiana State Teachers Association President Teresa Meredith. If you want to join the conversation, Please call us at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimitswfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about the state of education and the morale of educators here in Indiana in light of the teacher strikes, classroom walkouts, and other signs of dissatisfaction across America. My guests are teachers Ronnie Moore and Nick Brewer, and Indiana State Teachers Association President Teresa Meredith. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named John has done and send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. John writes, I have just retired from Lawrence North High School after a very satisfying 43-year career. I fear I am the last of the career classroom teachers, as I have seen many of my talented colleagues leave education altogether or move into administration simply because it is no longer possible to support a family on a teacher's salary anywhere in Indiana and elsewhere. We are entering a period of revolving door teachers, which cannot be good for kids or society. I was a department chairman, coached two sports, and had summer employment, all of which enabled me to support my family and send my two sons to college. Sadly and tragically, I could not recommend that either of them go into education because the field is not what it was when I started. I was able to get regular raises until the Daniels administration. From that point on, my salary dwindled due to lack of increases and inflation. A Department of Ed rep speaking to a town hall meeting at Lawrence North during the Daniels administration told the audience that good teachers could easily teach a class of 40 students. I was stunned. This individual has never taught in a classroom. His comments were indicative of the low esteem in which public school teachers were held. Morale did decrease dramatically over my career, though not through direct fault of my employers. I would like to add that I taught in an outstanding school district, MSD Lawrence Township, and for the most part had excellent administrators. But alas, if I were career-bound now, I would not begin a lifelong career as a classroom teacher. Teresa, you're shaking your head. You're shaking your head in dismay. Ronnie's sort of nodding hers in agreement, so I want to get both of your takes on this.
Well, I think it's the right time to come into teaching. What better time to be able to make not just change and support of students, but also for the profession, to really be able to come in and be part of the change agent that brings some sort of sanity back and some level of respect to the profession of teaching. I have a son in teaching. I have a daughter-in-law in teaching. I have a son studying to be a teacher and then two children who haven't chosen to teach yet, but I'm excited about that. I think we need the best and the brightest to come now and help us make things better.
Ronnie.
And I was shaking my head in agreement because I identify with so much of what was said in that email. Thank you so much for writing that. And I think that it's a good thing that we're having this, what's called an education spring, where people are talking more about the issues of teachers in the classroom. It's a time where there's a lot of conversation around teacher leadership. And I think that this, coupled with the strikes, is a good opportunity for us to get behind the cause of teacher leadership, behind the cause of keeping great teachers inside the classroom rather than creating incentives for them to leave so that they get the bump in pay, so that they get the bump in the benefits.
We are talking about education and the morale of educators here on No Limits. Betty, you're on the air.
Hello. I just agree with the email that just came in. I am encouraged that this is being spoken of, how 300 teachers in the Indianapolis public schools were just paid $20,000 to retire. And it upsets me that a lot of experience is being lost to the students of IPS. I was a teacher here for 44 years, retired now. I also want to make the observation that you said rural and urban districts were the one most suffering, but you don't have an urban educator on your panel to speak to that. It would be heartening if you did, because I think you would get a clearer picture of what's going on. And I think racism plays a large part, because the Indianapolis public schools are large part African American. And I think a lot more devastation has occurred to this district than any of the surrounding townships and other white, mostly white districts in our state. And I know that the rural districts suffer too, but this is doesn't seem to be a concern and has not been brought up by many people, that I think racism in our culture has been a big factor, that the mind trust privatization of public schools in Indianapolis was just allowed to go by the board with very little protest from anyone. And there has been such, I think we'll pay for it in the generations that already are existing at our cup.
Betty, I'm gonna step in real quickly here, because we've got a lot of other callers, and I want to give them a chance as well. I will say what I say often. Our studio is not an auditorium. There are a limited number of seats here at the table, and I always encourage our listeners to think of this as an ongoing conversation. We have done shows about education where we've represented different points of view in the past. We've had shows where advocates for school choice and vouchers have dominated the panel. We have had shows about the problems of urban education specifically. So while your point is well taken, I guess I would ask that you look at the thing as a totality. There's a reason we come here 104 times a year, so that one conversation does not stop the discussion. With that, I am going to shut up and let the panel respond to your points, which I think are valid. Thank you very much for the call and the observations. I'll start with Ronnie on that one.
Okay. So just to let everyone know, I work at a high school for adults. And actually, my school does serve a majority low-income students from minority backgrounds. So I suppose I am the resident urban instructor. So I think a lot of what you said is absolutely a good point to make. From my perspective, I've seen some of the new initiatives being brought to the fore by organizations like the Mind Trust, who are specifically targeting the groups that you mentioned. So I may not be the best expert on this subject, but from my perspective, it's just everyone's trying to get at this education, the problems in education, from different angles.
Gotten a Facebook message from a listener named Juliana. And again, you can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. She writes, I just read on Facebook that two of the guests are Teach Plus fellows. Could they please identify themselves and then whether they get paid to lobby?
I am a Teach Plus fellow. And while Teach Plus does give us a stipend to participate, I have never been paid to lobby, and I have never been told a specific position to lobby for. Teach Plus is, as far as my experience with it has...
Probably ought to explain what Teach Plus is.
Yeah. My experience with Teach Plus is it is a teacher advocacy group. They do lobby. They also help put teacher leadership in positions where they can have good impact on state laws or do things like be able to sit on a panel at WFYI. Through Teach Plus, but I have never been paid to lobby specifically a law.
Okay.
Absolutely. Again, also part of Teach Plus, we are very, the only thing that we've been asked to do is to elevate teacher voice, get teachers' voices at the table. So we are not paid to lobby at all.
Have another Facebook message from a listener named Andrew. It says, I wonder if a big difference between teaching now and in the past is the rise of college cost. I know a good amount of people that finish college with upwards of $60,000 in debt and going to a field where they make barely enough to pay that off. Is that part of the issue, Teresa, you're leaning in?
I think it might be a small part of it, but I really don't think that is the main reason that people are choosing other professions instead of teaching. I really think it has to do with the level of respect and autonomy that we have to do the job that we are well-trained to do when we head into classrooms.
We've also gotten an email from a listener named Rex. Again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Rex writes, I recently heard a report saying that businesses are having difficulty finding qualified job candidates. I wonder, would they be willing to give back some of that much ballyhooed business tax windfall to provide better education for the employee pool? Teresa, you're laughing.
Interesting point. We have been so focused on, and I say we collectively, this isn't educators or community members, it's the lawmakers, it's all of us, that we have allowed testing to drive so much of our instruction, and the funding is sucked up by all the testing costs, that unfortunately our students are really good at taking tests or making best guesses. But when it comes to being very practical and learning skills like we would have once been taught in things like home economics or life skills or shop class or financial literacy, those kinds of things, some of that's starting to come back, though. Those things currently in recent years haven't necessarily been stressed as much, but I do see a comeback.
We are talking about teacher morale and the state of education here in Indiana. If you want to join the conversation, please do what Ty has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Ty, you're on the air.
Yeah, as a person who takes their role in the public seriously to shape our public schools, where can we find objective information about how well our schools are doing? I know tests are often denigrated, and probably for good reason. But what other source of objective information is there that isn't anecdotal? Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call and the question. So I'll ask all three of you that one. Where do you find good information that's accurate and doesn't reflect a bias? And everyone is, this is like asking a question in class. Everyone's avoiding eye contact.
Well, Nick. I don't think that there is any one source of information that will ever give you the entire picture of how a student is doing. I think you have to look for a lot of different pieces of information to try to triangulate. But even then, a healthy dose of skepticism is always important when you're looking at whether or not a student is achieving their potential or whatever that case may be. It is hard to compare district to district, school to school, even student to student, because there are so many factors that go into a child's education. Our previous caller talked about the funding sources versus urban versus rural versus suburban, and all of that, as along with teacher quality, along with the student's home life, add to whether or not a student would be successful and therefore a school successful. So I don't think the answer is obvious. I think the best thing that an educator can do is look at a lot of data points and use that to triangulate.
Teresa.
Yeah, I think a community member can, instead of driving by a school and hoping there's a website to give them information, can find a way to stop in and visit a school, whether it's a school event that they stop in and just check out, whether they call an administrator or make an appointment. I think it's important to actually get in the school in your community and see what's happening. I think you can ask some key questions, find out what the turnover rate is, and find out what their explanation is of why if it's a high turnover rate, why is that? And then I would look at school board minutes and see if there's a way to begin to anything that you see that's a concern, begin to create conversation around that. But by and large, I think the best way to know what's going on in a school is to go there and see it for yourself.
We are talking about teacher morale and the state of education here in Indiana. Marianne, you're on the air.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I've been listening, and I heard someone else has actually already asked a question about Teach Plus. But a follow-up question to that, and the caveat first, I haven't heard a thing that anyone has said that I would disagree with. You are all three, excellent panelists. My question, though, is I am troubled that neither of the Teach Plus fellows identified themselves as that to start with. And the reason I'm troubled is, as I've been at the State House as a parent listening to committee testimony, Teach Plus fellows there tend also not to identify themselves And many of them actually have less experience than the two of you do. I think you actually both have quite good experience to be speaking. Is that a policy of Teach Plus? Are you told not to identify yourselves as being Teach Plus fellows? Or how does that happen?
Thanks very much for the call and the question.
Thank you.
Ronnie, I'll throw that one to you.
Sure. You know, I think it's just... I hate to say it, but I think it's just a coincidence. I've never been told not to identify myself as a Teach Plus teacher. I'm actually very proud to have been able to participate in this fellowship. So, yeah.
Nick?
Yeah, no, I have not been told to not identify myself either. So, again, I would be proud to say that I've worked with Teach Plus. They've kind of helped me find my political voice. So I don't – there's nothing that I'm trying to hide behind that.
And I am excited and honored to represent ISTA and be the ISTA president. But I am even more thrilled when I'm introduced as a kindergarten teacher. That is my first love. And though I'm not part of Teach Plus, I would imagine that you, if you love this profession like I do, you may feel the same way. So,
we've got an email from a listener named Mike, and I'm going to try to get to it because we're running out of time. Mike writes, my wife is a teacher outside Indianapolis, and I have three children in various stages of public education. So public education and teacher resources are very important to me and my family. On the question of what resources teachers need, clearly money is an issue. In a democracy, the government is us. I don't understand why we are cutting funding constantly over the past couple of decades for the country as a whole, in effect cutting our own future. Material resources are one thing. I'm glad you're talking about the morale of educators. No longer are teachers admired as a profession within the community. Pay is usually low. The testing and evaluation trends show that politicians don't trust educators to do their job. The focus on measurable outcomes degrades the value of soft factors that make the difference between a good education and a great education. The resource that teachers lack most these days is respect. There is a little more. I'm sorry, Mike. I had to edit it just to try to get it in here. Your response, I'll give each of you about 20 seconds because I think that cuts to the core of what we've been talking about. I'll start with Ronnie.
I absolutely agree with that. I think a lot of times when students are asked in college, you want to be a teacher? Why? The first thing that comes to mind is that teachers are not, it's not a well-respected profession. Teachers are not paid very well. If you're going to take a lot of money out to go to school, why would you pick a profession that's not going to pay you very much, and why would you pick a profession that seems to be going down?
Nick, about 15 seconds.
For me, I truly feel like teaching has been the best possible career path for me. So while I do agree there's a lot of things we need to lend our voice to fixing, I personally would encourage anybody to be a teacher. It's a fantastic, rewarding career.
15 and 10, if you can make it, actually.
All right. My first grade teacher changed my life. I have a great love and affection for public school educators, and I encourage your listeners to reach out to a teacher they know and tell them how much they appreciate and respect them.
That's a good last word. I'd like to thank my guests, Ronnie Moore, Nick Brewer, and Teresa Meredith, for what has been a lively conversation about education. I'd like to thank our listeners for great questions and comments as well, and invite them back to our show on Thursday when we're going to be talking about poverty. I am John Krall. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.